Good morning and welcome to the next installment of the Science Progress podcast series. I'm Assistant Editor Andrew Pratt, and today we are talking about stem cells and the upcoming World Stem Cell Summit. On the phone today we have Bernard Siegel, who is the Executive Director of the Genetics Policy Institute. We have Timothy Camp, who is Co-Director of the University of Wisconsin Stem Cell and Regenerative Medicine Center. And we also have Clive Svensson, who is also Co-Director of the UW Stem Cell and Regenerative Medicine Center. And we also have Science Progress Editor-in-Chief and University of Pennsylvania bioethicist Jonathan Marino. Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Stem cells have been in the news quite a bit recently based on some recent research, and it's a good time to be talking about them as we approach this big – this is the second annual World Stem Cell Summit that's been held?
Actually, it's our fourth one.
The
fourth
one.
Meeting, yes.
Well, that's excellent. So it's generating a lot of buzz, and we're here to sort of cover a range of different topics. So let me just sort of toss out something that's been in the news. Reprogramming and induced pluripotency have generated a lot of interest in the mainstream press as of late, but there are a lot of commentators who've jumped to the conclusion that this means work on human embryonic stem cells is no longer necessary. Now, researchers explain that this is by no means the case. Can we talk a little bit about why we still need to support human embryonic stem cell research?
Absolutely. It's interesting from an advocacy perspective. That,
this is Bernie Siegel. I think we need to identify
ourselves.
Yes,
we could
certainly.
Just...
This is Bernie. It's interesting to see in the policy debate how this breakthrough of induced pluripotent cells has been used. Some of the foes of embryonic stem cell research have declared victory, that there's no longer a need to fund the human embryonic stem cell research. And, of course, the scientists who are actually doing this research and working on IPS have said very strongly that human embryonic stem cell research still must advance if we're really going to try to understand the promise and fulfill the promise of stem cell research. We need to use all of these cells to eventually, hopefully, find treatments and cures.
This is Clive Svensson. I'd like to go along with Bernie's comment. My feeling is extremism in any area is dangerous. And I think, although this is an exciting new technique, relying on one single technique is not the way forward, particularly if we want to bring cells into the clinic as quickly as possible. And one of the issues that swirls around the induced pluripotent cells is the fact that you have to use very powerful genes to make them pluripotent. And these genes need to be then turned off when you, or if you use those cells in a clinical setting. So that's one example of a difference between the iPS cells and cells derived from human embryos, which don't have the induced genes expressed in them. Now, I'm sure this is a technical issue which will be overcome eventually. But like all things in science, one never knows how long that might take. And so we should be exploring all avenues of stem cell research in parallel and actually using one to support the other. I think they all strengthen each area.
This is Jonathan Marino. Could one of the scientists give an example for our listeners of how the ES cell lines, human embryonic stem cell lines, have already been useful in the IPS work?
This is Tim Camp. I would just add to the comments by Clive and Bernie that the iPS cells are promising and exciting and open new avenues, but I think we're still convinced that embryonic stem cells are the gold standard until proven otherwise. And I think getting to your question, how have embryonic stem cells been useful for the iPS cell work, is that basically the excitement about induced pluripotent stem cells is that they behave like embryonic stem cells. So if we didn't have embryonic stem cells and know what actually defines pluripotency, in other words, the ability to form all the different cell types in the body, it would be hard to know that we had iPS cells. So I think we're still in the long process of really understanding just how much an induced pluripotent stem cell is like an embryonic stem cell and its ability to grow for prolonged periods of time, its ability to differentiate into all the different specialized cell types that we're interested in. So I think the embryonic stem cells right now are the gold standard for a pluripotent stem cell, and certainly we're all excited about this first generation of induced pluripotent stem cells, but as Clive mentioned, there will be improvements to come in the future and much to learn yet.
There is one, this is Clive Svensson again, one twist to this story is I think Dr. Yamanaka in Japan, and certainly Jamie over here, without knowing exactly how to grow human embryonic stem cells in cultures, it's quite a complex technique. It would have been very difficult to even know that you'd induced a skin cell to be pluripotent. The 10 years of work that went on developing human embryonic stem cell culture really paved the way for this big discovery, and I think people should remember that human stem cells grow very differently from mouse. So we've had to learn from the human system and then apply that to the human skin cells that were induced. So to go back to Jonathan's question, I really think without the knowledge that we gained over the last 10 years from human embryonic stem cells, it's unlikely that the human iPS cells would have been developed as efficiently as they have.
Well, that's all very enlightening to hear. Let me jump ahead a little bit to the upcoming summit, and maybe Bernie, you could start off talking about this, but then also sort of understand it from scientist perspective. What are the goals here of bringing so many people together in Wisconsin? We're talking researchers, advocates, educators, even students. What do you want to come out of a large conversation that focuses on this one particular issue?
Sure. Well, you know, this is a very ambitious meeting, and it has grown since our first stem cell policy and advocacy summit that was at Baylor College of Medicine, where we brought in Dr. Michael DeBakey, sort of the great surgeon from the 20th century, to meet this burgeoning field in the 21st century of stem cell research. And we've worked with leading academic centers as we've progressed the conference with Stanford University and last year with the Harvard Stem Cell Institute. This year we chose as our partners the University of Wisconsin-Madison and their Stem Cell and Regenerative Medicine Center and the Y Cell Research Institute, of course, recognizing that it's a decade since Jamie Thompson's tremendous discovery and the derivation of human embryonic stem cells. What makes this conference different from others is that we bring in all the stakeholders to have a conversation, a discussion, and really try to chart the future of regenerative medicine, recognizing that this is a paradigm shift and a new way to understand the root causes of disease, create great new tools for drug discovery, and maybe one day have cell therapy. And so where other conferences might be purely devoted to research, and some others to the biotechnology industry and the commercial applications of this research, we bring in also as full partners in the conference the nonprofit world, Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, the Foundation Fighting Blindness, Christopher and Dana Reeve Foundation, and others, and the tremendous grassroots movement of patients, the ProCures movement, that really propels some of the funding of this research from the bottom up, not the top down. And it's also international in scope, so we have representatives from around the world and research institutes from around the world, from the Shanghai Stem Cell Institute to the Northeast England Stem Cell Institute. And together, this diverse mix, we throw together a tremendous program that covers issues that aren't often looked at other conferences, the policy issues, the advocacy issues, as well as the science and disease-specific panels. And together, having all of these groups interact, the patients with the scientists, with the business leaders, with the philanthropists, with the legal experts and bioethicists, we hope we can forge a path to move this and bring about cures sooner rather than later.
Well, and for Tim and Clive, as researchers, is this sort of an odd type of summit to combine talking about research with advocacy, or is that particularly effective in this case?
Clive Svensson here. I think more and more now we're trying to, in science, have a public face. So that what we do in our labs gets out to the general public. And in my field of neurodegenerative diseases, actually there are more and more meetings now where the patients and the patient advocates have their own sessions running at a science meeting. This is true for Huntington's disease, and in the next few weeks I'll be going to a meeting in England where the families have a parallel session for ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. So I think it's an important interaction. I think it's very good to pull people together in the same room that have different perspectives on disease. You know, patients can add a lot. Advocates can learn from the scientists. And scientists can get some feeling of where their work fits into the world. And I think we do live in our own little shoebox sometimes as a scientist. So I think this is very a healthy trend, and scientists have to think more that they do have to interact with the internet media now, more with the general public, and this is an opportunity to try and get accurate information out there.
This is Tim Camp, and I would agree with Clive and add that I think enhancing the public's awareness and understanding of science in general is a major mission that all of us as scientists should partake in, given the tremendous opportunities and needs for science education in this country as well as around the world. This is, for my field of cardiovascular research, though, somewhat unusual to have patient advocacy groups so directly involved in the meeting, and I'm actually looking forward to this quite a lot to really get the feedback, get the close interactions with all the different stakeholders that will be at this meeting. It is going to be a different meeting than I've ever attended, that's for sure, and so I'm looking forward to this sort of stirring the pot in a different way to really move things forward.
Excellent. Well, one of the things on the mind of a lot of these stakeholders is funding for this type of research. And so I want to pose the question, regardless of the outcome of the next presidential election, because we don't comment on electoral politics here on Science Progress, but what needs to happen during the next administration and also during the next Congress with regard to stem cell research and life sciences research in general, perhaps? But what needs to happen to sort of break some of the gridlock?
Well, you know, it's not a Democratic or Republican issue. It's a human issue. And clearly, we would like to see increased funding for embryonic stem cell research. When President Bush announced his limited funding on August 9, 2001, only about $160 million, we would estimate, has gone directly into the 21 or so stem cell lines in existence on that date for research, which has not been enough. Hopefully, next year, we're going to have a different political climate. We will be able to see NIH funding ramp up for this field that has been neglected at a federal level. We're concerned, of course, that NIH funding has been flat, and this could be a problem. Whether these restrictions are lifted or they're not lifted, there's not going to be enough of a pool of money to fund all the necessary research to advance the field. So that's a major concern. And of course, from a regulatory standpoint, we want to make sure that the FDA is operating well and can push this field, especially in the very first clinical trials for embryonic stem cell research, can move it forward safely, but also swiftly, because time's a-wasting. I think it also should be noted that because of the lack of federal funding, we have found, for the first time, states heavily involved in funding embryonic stem cell research, including California's Prop 71, that is promising $3 billion of research funding over a 10-year period of time. But that opens up a lot of confusion in that states have their own rules and regulations pertaining to how the money is going to be delivered and the regulatory requirements. And are those regulatory requirements going to match those coming out of Washington? So we want to make sure that we don't have a gridlock and that we are able to move all systems forward responsibly but quickly.
Certainly. Is there anything you'd like to add to that, Jonathan?
Well, I think what Bernie said is on target, particularly with respect to the need for some kind of federal coordinating role. When we talk about the NIH, it's the money's important, but the organizational ability that the NIH has, the experience it has, and the unique role it has in our system needs to be brought to bear, and the state role, which is welcome because we have experienced gridlock for the last 8 years in this area. Nonetheless, it does create a somewhat unprecedented situation. It's going to require a novel and innovative approach on the part of the federal government, NIH and FDA and others. The one thing I would add from a point of view of what we hope to see in the next administration is we want to see an executive order. I think we all agree with that. And it's entirely possible, I think probable, that there will also be another version of the Stem Cell Research Enhancement Act coming out of Congress. And I think that leads to two concerns. One is the possibility, whenever you're talking about legislation, that there could be some mischief with respect to impositions on the system that come out of Congress, depending on the composition of Congress, of course, to some extent, and who the president is. And also, there will have to be harmonization between an executive order and eventual legislation. So we can't really see our way through the clouds yet. But we're all hopeful, I think, that there, whatever happens will be better than what we've experienced recently.
Well, I want to ask sort of a pragmatic question of everyone at the roundtable here. What, and everyone has sort of different experience with cardiovascular research, with neural research. What are the potential applications of this regenerative medicine that are closest to clinical application? What are we getting close to that people can really get excited about? And maybe everyone could just point to one particular line of research that they find really promising that's getting close to clinical application.
And fair game is your own fields for Clive and Tim.
With Clive here again. Just one overall comment I think that people don't quite appreciate with regenerative medicine and stem cells in general is most of the work that's been done with adult stem cells implanted into different diseases has shown that the stem cells not only can replace tissues such as heart and brain and kidney or pancreas, but they seem to modulate how tissues function. So a diseased tissue can benefit from a stem cell transplant where the stem cell doesn't actually change into the desired tissue type. It seems to provide growth factors or support or perhaps more vascularization, blood vessels, through just being there. I think this is a fascinating idea that stem cells can support your own tissue. And that's the first phase, as far as I see, of where stem cells are now being used clinically, adult cells, and where we might start using embryonic stem cells to go into diseases not perhaps to replace cells, but to actually modulate systems. Now, if that's proven safe and effective to some level, we need to go the next level, which is to try and get the human cells to change into the correct tissue type. In my field, the brain, that's kind of a challenge because neurons in the brain have very complex connections. And I'll let Tim talk about cardiomyocytes and the heart in a second. So I think in the brain, again, we're thinking more in modulating your nervous system with stem cells. And some of the things that are close to the clinic there, my colleague David Gamm, going to be talking about this at the World Stem Cell Summit, is in certain retinal diseases, providing support to the retinal system through putting new stem cells in that basically rejuvenate the retina without replacing some of the complex systems there, maybe close to clinical trials. And in our own work, we're looking at ALS and perhaps Parkinson's disease, again, to put stem cells in to make support cells that are important for the brain, also to genetically modify them to release growth factors which can support tissue. So the stem cells may have initially some different and exciting roles to play in modulating your own system. And as we go along, we'll start working towards actual tissue replacement, which is where a lot of the challenges come in, getting appropriate differentiation. So that's just some thoughts, and I'll hand it to Tim.
Thanks. This is Tim, and I would be biased and say that in cardiovascular applications, the trials are underway. And I find them quite exciting that now investigators are testing primarily autologous or cells from self being transplanted into the hearts of patients with a variety of different injuries to their heart, most commonly after myocardial infarction or a heart attack, in which case after an acute thrombosis or blood clot in the heart blood vessel, the muscle downstream dies. And so it's appealing to think that you potentially can replace or improve that heart muscle. So what do we know so far? Well, we know that it seems to be fairly safe to deliver the cells to the hearts. the trials have been small so far, and it's not clear the extent of benefit, if any, at least to my reading in the literature. But I think it these trials are providing important proof of principle that that cardiovascular applications are progressing. We need to learn about the right cells for the job. Will it be autologous cells? Will it be an embryonic stem cell that's banked? Will it be an iPS cell? Will it be a mesenchymal stem cell? All those questions are still wide open, but I think given that heart disease is the number one cause of death in this country and is increasing in prevalence around the world, that this could have a significant impact on human health. Certainly, there are also a variety of other forms of heart disease, such as congestive heart failure, that really could be impacted in the long term by cellular therapy. So I'm excited about what I see coming down the road in my field, and it's already, as far as putting cells for repairing hearts, it's already being tested in clinical trials.
Well, that all sounds really, really exciting. I know that we're sort of closing in on a time window for our discussion here. If we could go around and maybe get some closing comments from people, stuff to think about. You know, where do we stand in relation to other countries around the world when it comes to stem cell research, and what do we really need to be saying to people who are skeptics, who might have ethical questions about this type of research going forward? But maybe if people wanted to go around and just sort of offer some closing thoughts.
Well, this is Bernie. I think what has happened in the political debate and ethical debate over this research over the past 8 years, 10 years, we have a great divide, but the promise of this research has been so compelling that when you scratch the surface and ask the man or woman in the street, people without a scientific background, do you support embryonic stem cell research? About 70% will say that they do. And they don't see it as some public health issue. They see it as a personal health issue, something that might impact their own lives or the lives of their loved ones or friends. And this is very significant. It's not a political movement that's been created, but it's akin to a consumer movement, a personal movement, a personal health movement. And this has great significance. And when you put this on a template, a political template, where foes of research have sometimes overreached, even calling for certain bans of forms of stem cell research that would put researchers in jail and impose heavy fines and could even be applied to some patients, you have a counter reaction to that. And that's where you find Proposition 71, where parents of children with diabetes ended up creating an initiative that now is going to support $3 billion towards the research, where you have the bellwether state of Missouri now writing in stem cell research, arguably as a fundamental right, and protecting it in their state constitution. So this is really turning things on its head. In the United States, this is a very powerful force. And globally, you find a great demand for this research. Other countries have realized the U.S. has fallen behind in funding on embryonic stem cell research. And they've made this, in some cases, a cause for economic development. They see this as a way that their own economies can get moving as part of the biotechnology revolution. And they're investing very heavily in this. In the U.K., in China, in Australia, in Israel. So they're making major advancements and arguably even in the published works, more scientific publications are taking up their research in embryonic stem cell research than in the U.S., even though we have a tremendous pool of talent and a lot of money being invested through private philanthropy in stem cell centers and academic centers around the country. So my closing thought is that this is a field that's on the move. The political climate is changing for the better, and the next 10 years we're going to see major advancements.
And I'll just add, this is Jonathan Moreno, I'll just add that one of the happier themes of the last 8 years has been the responsiveness of the scientific community, and I'll say this as a non-scientist too, the ethical challenges, both the national academies and the relatively new International Society for Stem Cell Research have put forward guidelines. These represent an effort by the scientific community to discipline itself, to organize itself, and to think ahead about ethical issues in this area. And I think that those efforts have been very important in helping to increase the comfort level of legislators and the informed public about the seriousness with which scientists take the ethical and policy issues.
Tim or Clive, any closing thoughts on maybe where research is in outside the United States?
This is Tim, and I would just say that I agree with Bernie that we have an incredible pool of talented researchers here in this country, which has kept us pretty well in the game. But obviously, without the support of the public and of our major funding and driving force in this country, the NIH, we're not going to be in the forefront forever. And so my hope is that as things change, that we really see efforts to really focus this area of research in the broad way, regenerative medicine and stem cell research, as it's really an effort at the NIH where, for example, we have comprehensive cancer centers that are funded through the NIH to really advance cancer research. Should we have such centers funded for stem cell and regenerative medicine to really get the focus there, get the support? We really need to have our main driving force for biomedical research in the United States take advantage of the opportunity here, because stem cells and regenerative medicine are going to transform medical care. They already are starting to, and in the next few decades, the impact will be tremendous. And so this is our opportunity to, again, lead in developing new treatments and new cures, and it's something that we really need to all get together and work on, both at the federal level as well as with disease-oriented advocacy groups and philanthropic support.
Well, Clive Svensson here. Just to add to Tim, you know, he said most of it. Coming from England, you know, we have pretty good oversight in England. We have a national structure of oversight, which has proved very beneficial for synergizing the academics with industry and with the government. So I think we can look to those sort of models in America in the long run, although we don't want to add another layer of complexity over the state rule. But that has to be done at some point, I think, to make things move forward and make the most of the American power, which is this widespread collaborative effort that we could set up within this country. One of the issues which I think will be brought out at the meeting is industry's role, and I think it's very difficult for industry to invest enormously at this stage in some cases, because the potential benefits may be 10 years away, and I think that's where big companies that are also going to be represented at the Stem Cell Summit are starting to look into this field, and they could really make things happen and move forward very quickly if they invest. And in terms of excitement for the field, where things are going, when I first heard about the iPS cells, you know, this is really alchemy, taking lead and turning it into gold. We can take an adult cell and make it pluripotent and make it do anything we want. And that, to me, is one of the most phenomenal discoveries. Really, Dolly the sheep, when they showed she could be cloned, set the whole field up in 97. And here we are today with this an extraordinary new finding, and I think it's going to revolutionize not just cell therapy in the future, but also allows us to look at diseases that we've never been able to look at before by taking skin cells from patients with specific diseases and turning them into the specific tissue type. And that way we can learn with human tissues maybe what causes some of these diseases. And so the legacy of this field, maybe far wider than the therapies, may really point to what causes diseases, and we might have some fundamental breakthroughs. And if the collaboration with the drug companies is very important at this point, the big pharma are getting involved. So those are my overall views.
Well, I think that's a great point to close on, that this is not just going to tell us about stem cells. This is going to tell us a whole lot about the human body and life sciences in general. Bernie, Tim, Clive, Jonathan, thank you all so much for joining me. I just want to point out that the World Stem Cell Summit is on September 22nd and 23rd in Madison, Wisconsin. You can learn more about it at worldstemcellsummit.com. Gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.